Welcome to Behind the Lore, a behind-the-scenes tour of the research and writing process that goes into making each episode of Lore. I'm Aaron Mankey. Today I'm joined by Robin Miniter, my teammate and the researcher behind the most recent episode of Lore, episode 123, Unnoticed. Together, we're going to discuss the stories that make up this episode and how it all came together. You've asked for a tour of the kitchen, so here you go. Welcome to Behind the Lore. Hey, Robin, how are you?
Hey, Aaron, I'm great. How are you?
I am great. I'm great. Super quick, getting geared up. Is this Friday? This is Friday.
It's Friday the 13th.
It is Friday the 13th and a full moon too, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Folks, if you feel compelled, go back and listen to episode 3. I think episode 3, The Beast Within. I can't remember what number that is. I've been doing this so long, I'm starting to forget what some of the numbers of the episodes are.
It's forgivable. It's okay.
Yeah. Well, and I'm also sort of like in this kind of weird time between times where like on Monday, this coming week, 123, well, the episode that we're about to discuss isn't actually going to publish for another few days. So there's that going on. Like by the time people hear this, it had been out for a week. But there's also the fact that I've written all the episodes for 2019 so that I could record them all, so that I could produce them all, so that I could spend a month and a half recording Unobscured Season 2, which I started today. Not started writing. Like Carl's been researching that and getting outlines put together for like 10 months. And it's crazy. But I recorded the first episode today, and that will ramp up very, very quickly. But I leave Sunday morning at like 4 in the morning for the airport so I can go on 8 days of tour. So 5 cities over 8 days. And I'm already tired. it's lots of flights. But the good thing is that I get to hang out when I'm on tour with Chad, and Chad plays music for us. He writes all the lore music, and he's so fun to hang out with. Chad's a foodie, by the way. He loves to find the best restaurants to eat at. Ooh. In every city we go to.
So does Chad have a list for you guys when you get out there?
Oh, most of the time he's already booked like 2 or 3 different restaurants on OpenTable. And then, you know, we'll review like as we're leaving the airport or something, and we'll pick one, and then he'll call and cancel the others. So he's a man about town when it comes to food. It's great. So
it sounds like you're in good hands.
Yeah. It'll be great. I'll probably put on weight and be very exhausted and under-rested, but it'll be okay. But what I would love to do is stay in a really, really luxurious hotel, and let's use that as our segue into today's topic. You, being a New Englander, probably loved researching this episode.
Yes, I do. And you know what? I know I've said this before, so some of our Behind the Lore listeners are going to recognize this, but I have moved a lot, and I love researching stuff from New England, especially like Massachusetts, New Hampshire, because mm-hmm. that is my neck of the woods, and I feel like every time I get this opportunity, I get to revisit some old places, of course, that I know about, but I also am always learning something new about them, and there's something really interesting about seeing home in a little bit of a different way, or have that history be a little bit more three-dimensional. So yes, and I love hiking up in the Whites. I summited Mount Washington a few years ago, and it was harrowing. So this was a fun episode to put together.
Absolutely. You know, you're reminding me, just talking about researching home, when I was middle school or early high school, my grandmother connected me with our family tree stuff. She's like, hey, I've been keeping track of this for, you know, decades, and why don't you help me with that? And I fell in love with genealogy as a, at least as far as my family's concerned. And I've dabbled in it off and on the rest of my life. But what I also love to do, and I think this is true of any town you live in, anywhere you live, there's always those cool people that did something, or they were like the first to, they put the first hotel up in town and pioneered the community. And I loved researching those things, like the stories about the place that I live that I never knew. And it makes it come alive, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It totally does.
So, you know, like to the extent that people have access and the ability and the free time, I think whenever anybody out there has a chance to dig a little deeper into the stories behind the place they live, like that's where the stories are really powerful, because they're people who walked the same streets as you and looked at the landscape in the same way as you, and It's neat to see what happens in your own hometown if you dig deep.
Definitely, definitely. I couldn't agree more.
So, you know, speaking of illustrious people and all that, I you know, it's important to, I guess, start with the dude who this hotel is all sort of wrapped around, which is Stickley, right? Joseph. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's part of this really elite group of people. I don't know if you've been, I'm sure, to Newport, Rhode Island, right?
I have, yeah. It's been a minute, but I think we went on a field trip one day when I was...
Oh, really?
That was one of our middle school field trips I think we went on.
Oh, that's cool. That would have been fun. My field trip when I was in high school was driving up to Chicago to go see the Federal Reserve Bank. Like, that was exciting as it got for us. But cool. I think going to Newport's a lot more fun. I've been as an adult, and it's great to tour those old houses. They're the size of, like, small government buildings. They're massive.
Totally. If you haven't seen them in real life, they're unbelievable.
Yeah. And the tours are relatively cheap. You can buy bundled tickets and stuff. And so that's like that crowd of people who built those homes, the Vanderbilts and all of that. This guy, Joseph Stickley, was sort of part of that culture and that circle of friends. And he made his money with coal, right?
Yes, I believe so. I think he did a little lumber as well.
Oh, did he really?
Think so, yeah.
It was
mostly coal.
Yeah, and you threw me for a loop when you put down on the outline that he was interested in a mineral called anthracite, but as I looked into it, it's essentially just like the most efficient coal you can mine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had never heard of it before.
No.
See, again, always a learning moment.
Well, I didn't know there were different kinds of coal, right? I just thought you just put coal. Well, I mean, I like to barbecue and smoke, and so like you can get briquettes of coal, which are those preformed like squares that look like giant little pillows. Or you can get the kind that I get, which just looks like somebody took a handful of chunks of wood and burned it, and that's your coal. And so I just honestly thought that coal, the stuff that came out of the ground, was all the same, but I guess not. Some of it's just better at doing its job, and maybe that's how he made his money, because he had the best coal. You know, he was the Steve Jobs of the coal industry in the 1800s. But he was a New Hampshire boy, and I love that even though he got big and wealthy and, you know, home in New York City, he felt pulled back to the White Mountains in New Hampshire and wanted to set up shop there.
Mm-hmm. He always came home.
He did. So the early days of him studying at this hotel are slightly confusing. Tell me a little bit about first the Mount Pleasant House and then sort of like his upgrade to something new.
Yeah. So from how I understand it, he originally built this place with the help of a local architect. And at one point or another, like, I feel like a lot of, you see this happen throughout history through a lot of these, if you want to call them the captains of industry or the robber barons, they set up shops in different places. And what I found in my research, folks will build one house and it won't necessarily be up to spec for whatever it is they're looking for. Perhaps it's not grand enough. It doesn't have all the amenities that they thought maybe they wanted. Mm-hmm. And they'll end up building something, A, either on that same spot, or B, like right down the road. In fact, in my hometown, there's a house. Maybe you've been there, in the Crane Estate. They did that exact same thing. They built one summer house. Then they were displeased with it, so they tore it down and put something else up. And so I believe that's what happened with Mount Washington. And so the Mount Washington Hotel actually became so much more grand and illustrious than the Mount Pleasant House.
I gotcha. Okay, so they were they on the same site then?
Yeah, I think they were like right across they were on a patch of land like right nearby.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. So basically they owned all of these acres up in New Hampshire. We're talking about the Mount Washington Hotel. Owned all these acres and they just built it basically like right next door.
Yeah.
And here in Ipswich, the house that I mentioned, they built it on the exact same spot.
Oh, interesting. A lot of the homes in Newport, Rhode Island, the big Gilded Age mansions, a lot of them started out of summer homes, some of them even in wood, that were then torn down and replaced with these big permanent structures. So I think it was like they started with a trial run with whatever was there, you know, and let's see if we can spruce it up. But at the end of the day, when you've got the equivalent of, you know, Jeff Bezos' fortune sitting there in your bank account, you say, well, why don't I just build the perfect house for myself?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So Mount Pleasant House sort of fades away, and then the Mount Washington Inn goes up. One of the things that I had to keep reminding myself as I wrote this was that it's not at the top of the mountain. I mean, it's Mount Washington Inn, and you would think that it's like up there, but it's not, because who wants to live up on top of the mountain? It's actually at the base, isn't it?
That's right. So the interesting thing about Mount Washington, I'm not sure if you've ever had the pleasure of going up there, but it is something fierce up there. So they have actually the highest recorded land speed wind records up there. So it's like almost like 240 miles an hour. The weather changes in an instant. It's really, really treacherous. And someone once told me, and I'll have to fact check myself on this, but someone once told me that there's been snow recorded every month of the year up there.
Yeah.
So to give you an idea, this is the tippy top of Mount Washington is probably not the place you want to stay when you go on vacation. Like, sure, you want to maybe like jump up and over it and then quickly return back down to the base where you can go to your nice hotel and go to the spa. And that's what the Mount Washington Hotel is.
Right. And of course, when you're staying in the hotel, you have beautiful views of the mountain, which is great. But yeah, you don't want to be up there. It's funny you use tippy top as a description, because the house that's on top of the mountain, I think, is called the Tip Top House.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And there's a train that goes up there, too, but it's a cog train because the climb is so steep. So the tracks have, or maybe it's just the wheels, but it's essentially like the wheels are gears that catch in the track, and it pulls it up the track instead of just a normal train where gravity's holding it down and friction is what allows it to move forward. Because it's so steep, this thing needs to literally like scale the side of the mountain.
Yeah.
So that tram is very particularly built for what it's doing.
Exactly.
So at the same time that he is probably about to start doing this, he meets a woman and they fall in love. She's a local gal from the Boston area, Carolyn. I can't remember what her last name was. Where's her name? Carolyn, just the daughter of a butcher.
Who later became known as Princess.
I know, right? I feel like, you know, at some point that's an upgrade, So I can't find her last name in here. Maybe it was in the notes and I just didn't include it because she very quickly became Carolyn Stickney. But yeah, they fell in love. She was much younger than him. And she was part of his building process of putting the hotel together, wasn't she?
Yeah, I believe she was, I think a little bit, but I think for the most part, she came along like a little bit later. He had this thing in the works. And then I think she came and had a little bit of stylistic and aesthetic influence in terms of the spirit that she brought to the place and the parties that were thrown and some of the amenities that they had. But I think the design was mostly in his own imagination.
Yeah. I'm blown away by the size of this thing. The numbers that you put in the outline, they're staggering. I mean, like, again, if you tour a Newport mansion, you're going to see big places. But I think you put, I'm trying to find it here, that there was over like 200,000 square feet of wood flooring throughout the building, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And something like 50,000 square feet of roofing tin and just miles and miles and miles of pipes. I mean, to me, I know what this thing looks like, of course, but those numbers feel almost like they're inconceivable. Like I can't even imagine what that actually looks like in practice. Of course, you know, I'm no architect nor contractor, but this thing is big.
Oh, like the electrical wiring, wasn't it like 20 or 21 miles of electrical wires throughout this thing? That's a lot of wire.
Yeah, and I just love that Thomas Edison himself showed up to do the job. Like, I love that fact. It's like, yeah, that's you get the best for the job, I suppose.
Right,
Money buys you good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, he's an inventor, but when your friends are all ultra wealthy people, I guess you're like the electrician for the wealthy.
Totally.
So he shows up. I feel like I've read a story where he did that for somebody else too, but I can't remember what it was. So I'm gonna say this is the only time he's done it, and I'll be wrong about that. It's enormous. It's enormous. And they have three separate train stations nearby, in Brentonwood, to get this steady flow of people coming through. And I imagine at that time, I don't know, we like to get away to the coast, you know, we'll go to Rockport, or if we really want to have a fun day, we'll go up the coast to Southern Maine to a little village called Ogunquit. And it's one of my favorite places in the world. and walk the marginal way and do all that stuff. But I feel like a lot of these people wanted to go inland and to go up the mountains felt very important. So there were a lot of guests that were coming through.
Totally. And part of that too, you know, you have to remember the time of these folks, you know, where they're coming from. Cities were hot and they were overcrowded and medicine wasn't what it is now. And so I think oftentimes you have folks who want to get out of these congested sick cities, get some of that fresh mountain air that you hear often prescribed over the course of history to treat various ailments. But also there's some element of exclusivity to this. You know, these folks, they had to have automobiles. They had to be able to afford to go by trains. You know, it was almost like its own little private social club that these folks were able to access if they had the means to.
Yeah, no, it totally. I mean, you put it in that perspective, it sounds like a, it's a piece of privilege. It's a, for those who were better off, they could afford to do these things. I also, I know it was in the late 1800s when a lot of people were, like tuberculosis patients were going out to places like the Rockies, you know, Colorado and all that, because it was the same thing when you lived in Europe, where you would go south, you'd go to the south of France, or you'd go to Italy or Venice because the weather was supposed to be better for your whatever ailments you had. And there was a lot of that going on in the late 1800s in America. Folks with tuberculosis were moving to more mountainous areas where the air was supposed to be cleaner and, you know, untouched by the polluted cities that they were in. And that was like the extent of what they thought could cure tuberculosis for a long time. Yeah. Like Waverly Hills Sanatorium in, was it West Virginia, I think?
I don't remember where that one was.
I don't remember where that was either. Again, I've done a lot of these things. I've written 132 episodes. Sometimes things fall out of my head.
It's okay.
But they had open air rooms where people would just sit, whether it was summer or winter, for the fresh air to be healing for them. So I can see how a lot of people would want to go up to these resorts. But it's not like this place was rustic. Like, they did a really good job of making this nice.
Yes.
I think there was we might be getting ahead of ourselves here, but there was a golf course and I'm trying to find it here.
Stables. Spas.
And then they open up and a year later, tragedy strikes, right?
Yeah. Joseph was in New York and he died of a heart attack. He wasn't even that old. Unexpectedly. And it seemed like up until that point, you know, there's not a lot written about him in the record, but he seemed like he was robust and full of health. And he had been entertaining lots of famous folks up there. And then just one day, boom.
That was it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So here you have Carolyn Stickney, who is a lot younger than him. She's now a very wealthy widow. In some ways, I kind of think of her like Jacqueline Kennedy, you know, where when JFK died, she had a ton of her life ahead of her.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, well, I'll ride out the last 10 years in widowhood and just enjoy the quiet. It was, you know, what do I do with my life now? And it seems like she did a lot with her life right after his death. Well, let's see. He died in... it opened in 1902 and he died a year later, so 1903. Mm-hmm. And then it was, what, maybe a decade later, the World War I broke out in Europe?
Yeah, just about.
Yeah, and she served over in Europe. She went to France. She won the Gold Medal of Reconnaissance by the French government. She served with the Red Cross, getting her hands dirty, not just throwing money around, but actually doing things on the ground, which I thought was really commendable of her.
Yeah.
And then she met a guy. She met a prince. I have deleted my pronunciation guide for his name. I could try. Fossigny Lucinge. Yeah. Prince Aimon du Fossigny Lucinge.
I have your pronouncer in front of me if you want me to,
Oh, I bet you do. Yes, you try it.
Let's see. Aimon du Fossigny Lucinge.
Lucinge. Okay.
There's my like high school French coming out and not even well.
Yeah. I've learned over many episodes that it's the languages you'd expect to have no problem with, like French, because it's, you know, isn't it a Latin language?
Yeah.
And I just expect to have no problems with it. And those are the ones that I always have problems with. But you give me Japanese and I'll pronounce that pretty nicely every time.
Interesting. Can you read?
No, not at all.
Just the pronouncers.
Just
the,
yeah. Well, yeah. In I think we've talked about this before, but the reason why, oh, it was on Marcette's episode of the Japanese castles, because what we have written down for Japanese names are essentially white Europeans who got to Japan, listened to the words and wrote them down phonetically so that their white European brains could understand them. And that's why when you look at a word in Japanese, a company name or a place name, if you sound out what you see on the page, you're more often than not just going to nail it. Because it was written down that way on purpose. Yeah.
All right. There we go.
Yeah. And it seems like the hotel did well. They had lots of famous guests during this time after his death, right?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Who they have? They had Rockefeller, Bob Hope, Hitchcock, Babe Ruth. They had a few presidents who came through. It was sort of like the place to be, actually.
It was. Yeah. And another princess, too, Princess Margaret, which must have... I don't know if that caused a little kerfluffle or not. Maybe.
Oh, I wonder.
Maybe they had a princess off.
Yeah.
Little battle.
Be so graceful.
Yeah. So wrapping up her story, it looks like in 1922, after being married for less than a decade, her prince dies, and now she's again single. I don't know what she inherits from his name or title. I don't know if she inherits anything. I don't know how French hereditary stuff works, but she certainly comes back and spends a lot more time at the hotel after this.
Mm-hmm. And that's where she lives out her days. That just becomes her roost.
Did she die there?
Makes sense. You know what? That's a great question. I don't know if she died in the hotel or not. That should have been the first question I asked. I don't know.
I mean, we know she died in 1936. Mm-hmm. But like a nephew takes over the hotel. I don't know that I ever bumped into anything that talked about where she died. So I don't know if she died in the hotel
or not. Yeah. I mean, it would not a bad way to go. It would make sense. But I think if she did die in the hotel, we would most certainly know about it.
Yeah, I think so.
That's a good way to end the story.
So one of my favorite tales about her when she's alive and in the hotel is this thing where the ballroom where people would gather to have dinner, the dining room, I guess, had a window in it with a curtain that was high up, and she could come in from, I don't know, like the second floor, whether it was a secret hallway or just a hallway, and she could come over to the window and peek down, and she would check out what the ladies were wearing that night, so that she could go back to her room and find a dress to beat them all. And I thought that was the greatest.
Totally. And I kept thinking that because I imagine she had very good eyesight. Because I think this thing was a balcony. And so she would have to peek through and be able to scan the room. Very strategic.
Yeah. Yeah. If you've ever been to the, I doubt anybody else listening, but you probably have, the Hawthorne Hotel in Salem.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Their ballroom. I was there for the Unobscured season one, premiere party last year. And we used the ballroom. And if you're at the far end of it and you're looking back toward the doors and you look up the wall, there's a small, two or three windows up there. And it's because on the second floor, there's a little function room and a hallway that leads over to those windows. And you can sit up there and you can watch the people down below having their party. And that's sort of what I envision her little setup to be. It was her little trade secret, I think, because she would just show up having beaten everybody with her clothing. But it's because she cheated.
Yeah, well, I wonder, now that you mentioned that, the architectural feature of the Hawthorne Hotel, I wonder if that was sort of the move of folks who were building these places.
It could have been. I think so, yeah. So she passes away, her nephew takes over for a while, but eventually, just as a little side note to wrap out this little section here, but I love that they open it back up a couple of years before 1942. No, they closed it in 1942. But when the war ends, when World War II ends, all the Allied countries, they want a place to hold a big gathering of the nations to talk about how to move forward. And for some reason, they picked the Mount Washington Hotel.
Mm-hmm. Because it was very secure.
Really?
Because
was that it?
Yep. Because it was so remote that they were able to post people on the, one or two roads in and out of there. And it'd be very hard to spy, from what I understand.
Oh, that makes sense.
So it was pretty safe. Yeah, it was a safe place to have all these really important folks coming and having these really important conversations.
Seems like a James Bond movie from the 60s.
Kind of, a little bit. I'm sure there are a few martinis that were had during these agreements.
And then and somebody in a tuxedo had to ski down the hill being chased by armed men on skis.
Most likely.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Yeah. So, but what I love, the little throwaway detail that's just so fascinating is that she had her own like dining room table that she ate at all the time. And so when they had this big Bretton Woods agreement where all these global nations came together and signed the paperwork to move forward and help rebuild the world, they did all of that right on her desk, her dining room table. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. What a nice like homage to her. And I believe from what I understand, that was intentional. I think that was the move.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
Because she had been the proprietor of this fine establishment for so long. And I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah. Well, and like we said earlier, having done her service in World War I and gotten on the ground and gotten dirty and used her hands, I feel like it's sort of fitting. The princess's dining room table became the place where the documents were signed. So I like that. But then, there's all these stories about the place, and most of them are pretty darn creepy.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a favorite one?
I'm trying to remember. I think the way that, it has to do with room 314, which, if I remember correctly, that was her private residence, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So, again, if we knew where she died, I feel like it would make these stories about her room in particular a lot more powerful. But, so I have a couple of friends who were part of the original Ghost Hunters cast, maybe within the first couple of years. So Steve Gonzalez and Amy Bruni are friends of mine. And I reached out to both of them because I know that they had done an early Ghost Hunters episode at the Mount Washington Inn. And I love the story they told about setting up a recording device in room 314 and calling out, "Are you here?" And capturing a voice that seems to say back to them, "Of course I'm here. Where are you?" It feels like something that Princess would do. So I asked both of them just for like their feelings on the place, stuff that I couldn't put in the episode, but I wanted to know what they felt about it. And they're like, "Oh, it's one of their favorite places in the world to go and investigate. It's beautiful. And it's also just as creepy as all the stories say. Like things do happen there, according to them." And those, I trust Steve and Amy. So
Yeah. I'd be curious to ask them how the place feels different than some of these other Victorian era hotels. Like what strikes them what strikes them about it in particular? I'd just be curious to know.
Yeah.
Maybe next time you talk to them, you can
I
ask
will.
Them.
Yeah. Or compare it to like the Stanley, which as I wrote this one, I felt like it was akin to the Stanley Hotel. Which one?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking about the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs.
Oh yeah,
that we did an episode about a few episodes back.
Yeah,
but that's a little bit different though, the history there. So
that one was more of a resort hotel. Stanley was another wealthy business entrepreneur who started a car company and made a ton of money and built a hotel. A lot of these rich people just built houses for themselves, but a few of them, like Stanley and Stickley, built hotels where people could come and stay in their space. I'd love to get their thoughts on comparing them, if they feel similar or different. Did you have favorite stories from that last act of the episode?
Ooh, So I think this particular act, there weren't stories in here that surprised me as much. But what I did love the same as that you mentioned, the story about Carolyn greeting your friends, and even this little bit about her sitting on the end of the bed and brushing her hair. Cause to me, there's something really tender about that.
Mm-hmm.
She clearly is a sweet spirit, she was sweet in life and seems to be, in death even. But my favorite story actually, is the one about the paintings.
Oh yeah. And it was Amy Bruni who told me this story.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll let you go ahead and regale that one. I love it too. I totally do.
And this one it's so absurd. And I think that's part of the reason why I really liked it. And so you had found this one for me. And so as the story goes, today in the Mount Washington Hotel, you have your portraits, one on the wall of Carolyn Stickney and the other one of her husband.
Right.
However, it's not actually her husband. It's the wrong Joseph Stickney.
Yeah.
That had been drawn. So an artist had been commissioned to draw the portrait of this man. And not only did the artist draw the wrong person, the artist drew the picture of a man who had been murdered in cold blood. So it's like,
right.
The question that I'm left with is, I have so many questions about it. You can imagine how that might have happened way back in the day.
Yeah.
But my question is, why haven't they replaced it? Why is it still there?
Well, that is the question. And I think when Amy saw it the first time, she does this. So Amy used to be on Ghost Hunters. She now has a TV show on the Travel Channel called Kindred Spirits. And she also on the side runs sort of like a ghost tour getaway weekend sort of thing called Strange Escapes. So they'll go to a place like the Stanley or Mount Washington and they'll book the weekend and guests can come and stay and they'll do like paranormal investigation together. They'll do lectures about the history and the stories that are told about the place. It's sort of like a full immersive lore episode in person with people who are experts in that area or, you know, experts in the field in general. And she said they were there for one of the first ones they did there. And she asked the hotel staff, she's like, why is this still on the wall? I mean, granted, I think that both of the portraits were done long after both of them had passed away. So it's not like there was family around to say, no, you got that wrong. Like people just accepted the paintings and put them on the wall and didn't know. Mm-hmm. And I've looked up the photos of both of these men or the etchings of both of these men. They look very different. It's not like
they look if we so different.
Yeah. Yeah. You've seen it too, right? You put those in the outline. If you squint, it doesn't help. They're still very different guys.
No.
So
there's like a 3 or 4 decade age difference. You know,
yeah, there's
one
that too,
man has
right?
like a long white beard. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, yeah. It's like asking for a painting of Santa Claus and what you get is a painting of Pee Wee Herman and you put it on the wall and just claim it Santa Claus. Like that's the difference that we're talking about here. So
totally. That is exactly it.
Yeah. So she's asked them that and I don't remember if they've really given her an affirmative answer or not, but they're going back in November. And at the end of the episode that will come out that people have already heard, I feel so pulled out of time. It's weird. I give people some information on her strange escapes. I think it's in November. And there are still tickets available. So if you're looking for a vacation in early November and you want to go to a haunted hotel with Amy, you can do that. She said she's going to ask them again, or at least check and make sure that the painting is gone at this point. But just to think that these paintings have been hanging on the wall next to each other for decades, and it's the wrong guy.
I know. It's like poor Carolyn. Like, oh
yeah, yeah. And, you know, some people think that that's why there's a bit of unrest in the hotel. Who knows? But it's a fascinating story because mm-hmm. if you're not educated in the stories about the hotel when you arrive, if you're just a guest checking in and you see those portraits hanging up, you just assume, right? Like you think, oh, those are the people that started this place.
Of course.
Because we're trusting of stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, you would have thought the artist would have fact checked, right?
I mean, in a sense, he did. The painting looks like the photo he found. It's just the photo of the wrong guy. So,
he just didn't stick the landing.
No, he didn't. Yeah. I mean, he completed all three rotations in the air. He just landed on his knees instead of his feet and probably broke something. So, okay, we've butchered that metaphor. Yeah, so fascinating hotel. I want to talk briefly about the epilogue before we wrap up, though. This was a great story.
Back to the top of the mountain.
Yeah, here we go. Because again, this weather is, and you hear it all the time. Like the weather changes every minute. It's always a hyperbole whenever you're talking about it anywhere else. But at Mount Washington, it is not hyperbole. It literally changes from moment to moment. I've read that either you might know this. It's either L.L. Bean or North Face tests their winter gear on the top of Mount Washington.
Ooh, I believe both of those things.
Probably both of them. Yeah.
Ooh, it gets fierce up there. Like exactly how you say, like when you go hiking, you have to be so careful to bring all your different layers, all your snacks and be ready to get down that mountain if a storm comes through.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's the problem with the story we're telling in the epilogue, where Lizzie, her uncle George, and George's daughter, her cousin, can't remember her name.
What is her name?
Lucy.
Lucy.
So Lucy, Lizzie, and George. Number one, they're not from the area, right? They came from Kennebunk, which is on the coast of Maine. Kennebunk Port is the port version, or the smaller village, and that's where like the Bushes live, you know, George Senior, George Junior, and all this stuff. And they're not, I don't think they're just, in general, they're not prepared. And then they hit a snag with the weather that morning, so they don't get to start early enough. And so when they do start, they're already late in the day, and it turns out that they're doing a bunch of road work going up the mountain, and so that slows them down. So they're not at the top by the time darkness begins to fall, and that it proves bad for them.
That's right. And that's the irony of it. They were so close, but a fog had descended, and then they just couldn't see beyond, you know, the next false summits. And, you know, the White Mountains are famous for their false summits, and also for, you know, being underestimated. You know, 5 miles up there is not a 5 miles really kind of anywhere else.
No,
yeah.
It's not. No, it's slower. It's more difficult. I'm baffled why they didn't turn around, because they knew the day was getting later. They could see the light fading, and they were going to have to walk all the way down again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just sounded like, you know, Lizzie just started feeling a little faint, and maybe they just laid down to rest, and then things took a turn for the worse.
Yeah. George does this thing where he decides he's going to build a wall with some of the stones to block the wind from them as they rest, because it's super windy up there, as we said. I guess he does. He builds a small little windbreak wall. But when he gets back to the young ladies, he discovers that Lizzie is dead.
Lizzie is no more.
She is no more. She is cold. Everybody's cold, but she's cold.
That's bad.
That was cold. I'm sorry. That was cold of me.
Aaron.
Very cold of me. It's the irony is so bitter. When the morning comes and the fog lifts, they can see the Tip Top House from where her body is. Like, they were that close.
They were that close. And they had to go up and get somebody to help them bring her down.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. So that train we talked about earlier, the cog train, it still runs. You can take it up to the top. My father-in-law hiked the mountain a few weeks ago and took the train down, I think. Mm-hmm. And it goes by a big pile of stones with a memorial plaque in honor of Lizzie.
That's right. That's right.
But it's not just a tragic story, because it's a weird place to have hauntings, but there have been hauntings on the side of the mountain near her memorial, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly that. They say that sometimes on those moonlit nights, people have seen her. Have seen her spirit hovering by this memorial. She doesn't ever seem to engage too much, but she seems to be definitely there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So there you have it. I think we've reached the top.
Yeah. You know what? We love our puns over here at Lore Headquarters.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I love the puns. I love them.
I'm a dad, and they kind of just fall out of me. I believe that once you become a parent, whether it's through natural birth or adoption or whatever the process, once you have a child in your life, it turns on a latent like superpower, and you become really corny.
Love it.
Yeah. And
I love it.
One of my kids in the car the other day said something about, "Dad, your jokes are so lame. It's great." And I was like, well, that's sort of an underhanded compliment, but
I was going to say, yeah,
I'll take it. I'll take it.
Oh, that's very sweet. That's very sweet.
So,
this was a good one.
Thanks. I loved writing it. You did a great job on pulling these details in, and I hope that folks enjoy their, you know, trip to the hotel.
Exactly. And when you go hiking, be sure to bring your water.
Oh my gosh.
That's my PSA.
Yeah, and a windbreaker. And a windbreaker.
And a windbreaker, and maybe even a sweater. I'm just going to throw it out there.
Or maybe just don't hike up there and take the train.
Or just take the train and you can take it down.
Yeah, if you want to hike in New England, there's a lot of safer places. Go to Monadnock, or, you know,
yes,
go walk the marginal way and just have a casual walk, something. But don't die on Mount Washington. That's just, that's dumb.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool. All right. So I think I'm trying to think of the next one I've got with you.
But we can't
actually talk about it.
Nope. Can't do it. I think I know which one it might be.
Yeah. Okay. and we'll be recording it soonish. I've got a week of tour, and then because we have weekly episodes coming up in October, that's sort of how Lore and us all here at the company celebrate Halloween. We do weekly episodes instead of every other. So there are 5, I believe, episodes in October.
Woohoo!
So we'll blow through a lot of the ones that I have written and recorded very quickly. And that means if I can hold on and stay ahead of my schedule, that means we're going to get 5 behind the Lores in there too. So I'm sure we'll be back on here in just a couple weeks.
Sounds great.
All right. I'll leave you to it, and I'll catch you soon.
All right.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
And that does it for today's episode of Behind the Lore. Big thanks to Robin Miniter for all the hard work on the research behind this episode. And remember, you can learn more about everything going on in the world of lore over in one central place, theworldoflore.com/now. On behalf of the entire Lore team, thank you for your constant and generous support and for letting us tell you our stories. And until next time, thanks for listening.